This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This appears to be a time of change in Southeast Asia. Thailand's pro-democracy movement forced the ouster of Prime Minister Suchinda, a former general who had never been elected. In the Philippines, there was a free and fair presidential election for the first time in 23 years. The UN is overseeing peace accords in Cambodia. We invited Sidney Jones to talk with us about how much progress is being made in the direction of democracy in the region of Southeast Asia. Jones is the executive director of Asia Watch, which is part of the group Human Rights Watch. She lived in Indonesia for 4 years, although now she is blacklisted and banned from returning. She's a former staff member of Amnesty International. I spoke with her this morning before the announcement that phase two of the Cambodian peace talks would proceed without the Khmer Rouge. I asked her first about the news from Thailand this morning that a new prime minister had been appointed.
The person who was chosen is a man named Anand, who's interesting because he's very respected. He was the person who was appointed prime minister after the military coup in February 1991, and he surprised everybody by not only being absolutely incorrupt and leading one of the most honest governments Thailand's ever had, but also in standing up to the military. The problem with him is that he's not elected, and this whole democracy movement was to push for more democracy, more elected officials. And the Thai parliament passed an amendment today that every prime minister from now on has to be an elected official. So it's clear that his position is only an interim one.
So this new constitutional amendment says that the prime minister has to be elected. Do you know when those elections will take place?
It's not clear. It's also not clear how long Anand will stay in power. Some people say that as soon as the House takes its seat, because since the March 22nd election, the newly elected House hasn't met, that it should be dissolved and new elections called. There are other people that say that Anand should serve for a period of about 6 months. So it's not at all clear, and I think people are still worried about the volatility of the situation.
Now, the pro-democracy movement in Thailand was really led by the middle class, as I understand it. Is there a growing middle class in Thailand?
Not only is there a growing middle class in Thailand, there's a growing middle class throughout Southeast Asia. And I think that's been the most important factor in pressing for democratic change throughout the region. There used to be this assumption that because the countries were growing economically and because more and more people were prospering, that what their real concern was for the money to keep coming in, and they weren't particularly interested in democratic change. And I think one of the most important lessons of the Thai events is that that's a completely false assumption. The more people do grow wealthy or at least better off than they were before, the more they want to stay in their own government. And I think that's what the democracy movement was all about.
Several of the countries in Southeast Asia have been undergoing something of an economic boom. But on the other hand, the countries have been under authoritarian control. And a lot of people are saying it's the authoritarian control that has made the economic boom possible because everything's so tightly regulated. I'd like you to connect that to the rise of the middle class.
Well, I think that it's true that many of the countries in Southeast Asia have been undergoing an economic boom, and there are some of these countries that are regarded as being the next South Koreas or the next Taiwans. And to some degree, it probably has been a long period of relative stability that's made that growth possible. But there comes a time when it becomes counterproductive to keep the controls in place. And one of the things you've seen after the Thai movement is that investors are getting very wary of investing in Thailand because of the possibility of political instability. You even had stories of Thai bankers and other people who had, in fact, benefited from the period of economic growth deliberately selling shares on the Thai stock exchange to make the stock market fall and discourage investors, figuring that economic pressure on the government might be the only way of really exerting pressure to change the government and get rid of Prime Minister Suchinda. So there has been a linkage between the economic growth and demand for democratic change. I think probably at one point there was a connection between the period of authoritarianism, if you like, and the benefits that the middle class received. But there's no question that the middle class and the growth of the middle class are responsible for some of what we see now in the region.
My guest is Sidney Jones. She's the executive director of Asia Watch, which is a human rights group. You know, there's an argument that goes that Asians don't want Western-style democracy because it could compromise their economic gains. I think you've addressed that. The other argument goes that Asians don't want Western-style democracy because of cultural differences. They've been brought up respecting authority, valuing consensus, accepting their position in life. What do you think of that?
I think that that argument is often used as a pretext for keeping on dealing with authoritarian leaders. I'm not sure it's true. I think it is true that it's not necessarily the case that even members of the Asian pro-democracy movements want a wholesale import of Western institutions. They don't necessarily want to have a two-house parliament or multi-party systems the way the European countries have them. But there is certainly a demand for basic freedom of association, freedom of expression. They don't want to be thrown in prison every time they criticize the government. I think the quest for those kinds of freedoms is very clear and growing throughout the region. So the idea that Asians are somehow comfortable with an authoritarian leadership, I think is nonsense now.
What role would you like to see the United States and other Western countries play in ensuring human rights in countries of Southeast Asia or in encouraging pro-democracy movements?
I think the United States has basically played a much too soft-spoken role and in some cases a directly counterproductive role in the region. If you look at testimonies in Congress, for example, by members of the State Department on Southeast Asia, they emphasize the growing trade and investment between the United States and the region. They emphasize the communication links. They emphasize the cooperation that Southeast Asia gave to U.S. efforts in the Gulf War. There's not really a concern for the mistreatment of citizens of these countries by their own governments. And it's as though most of the time the United States would prefer to shove the human rights concerns under the table and pretend they're not there while trade and investment and business increases. I think this is a wildly misguided policy because I think in the long run it'll hurt business, it'll hurt investment, and it will hurt trade if the end result of ignoring human rights abuses is to create more instability in these countries.
I'm going to ask you to help us interpret some of the recent changes in some of the countries of Southeast Asia. Let's start with Cambodia, where the UN is overseeing a peace plan. Now, the Khmer Rouge just seceded from phase two of this peace plan. They said they won't participate in the second phase of the peace accord, which calls for the containment and disarmament of most soldiers. Why did they pull out?
They pulled out ostensibly because they accused the United Nations of not living up to its part of the agreement of verifying the withdrawal from Cambodia of Vietnamese military advisors. One part of the peace agreement initially is signed in Paris was that there would be verification of the withdrawal of all foreign military elements and advisors. The Khmer Rouge have made great political capital inside Cambodia of saying that the government is still under the control of the Vietnamese, that there's still many Vietnamese advisors. This is from the period in 1979 when Vietnam invaded Cambodia and basically throughout the Khmer Rouge. So they're using this as a pretext for not going along with the UN accords and the demobilization and disarmament stage. I must say that nobody really expected the Khmer Rouge to go fully along with that plan anyway. Everybody believed the Khmer Rouge was still stockpiling arms, and even if they made pro forma efforts to turn in weapons, they really weren't going to be serious about it. But it's very, very disturbing and very dangerous that they've essentially called a halt to the peace process at this stage. And nobody's quite sure what to do next because the whole peace process is contingent on all four parties agreeing.
There were recently elections in the Philippines. Can you give us your analysis of the meaning of those elections?
The Philippines is a sad case because everybody held it up as a shining example of democracy after Mrs. Aquino returned to power or took power after the fall of Marcos in 1986. And instantly, there were all of these democratic institutions established. The Philippines Congress came back. There was freedom of the press. There still is freedom of the press. But the economy was in such a shambles that you got a resurgence of the kind of warlordism that's plagued Philippine politics for the last several decades. And in these elections, you had seven candidates running that covered the spectrum from Imelda Marcos at the bottom to an anti-corruption campaigner, Miriam Defensor Santiago, at the other end. And in between, you had old Marcos cronies like Cuanco, who's Cory Aquino's cousin. And you had the person who appears to have won the election, Fidel Ramos, who had been chief of staff of the armed forces under Mrs. Aquino in 1986 and then defense minister. And he is now probably going to become president, but with less than 30% of the vote. And this is a real problem because the Philippines has been plagued by political turmoil and disaffection within the various ranks and services of the military. There are many people that speculate that because he has such a low percentage of the vote that he may in fact face a coup attempt. And I think this is one thing we all have to wait and see.
I think the statistic is 65% of the population of the Philippines is below the poverty line. Do you think it's going to be more difficult for the Philippines to enjoy the economic growth of the more authoritarian countries of the region?
I think it's clear that it's almost the basket case of the ASEAN countries, of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, but it's not because it doesn't have an authoritarian government. If you think of the authoritarian government it had when Marcos was in power, and in power for more than 25 years, it was Marcos's authoritarian leadership and corruption on an unprecedented scale that led the Philippines directly into the economic problems it's facing now. So there's not necessarily a correlation between authoritarian rule and democracy and economic growth in this case. I think if the Philippines had had a democratic government in the 25 years preceding Mrs. Aquino, it might have had a much better economic situation than it has now.
Even under Aquino, your group Asia Watch was issuing reports about human rights abuses in the Philippines.
Yes, very much so. And in fact, we were very disappointed that there wasn't a better performance on the human rights side than there was under Mrs. Aquino's leadership. And part of the problem was an inability to control the military and basically giving the military a carte blanche to go after the communist insurgency, the New People's Army, without respecting the human rights of civilians who were living in areas where the NPA was operating. And even today, you have left-wing activists who are operating legally and above ground being targeted by gunmen who are working for the military in either an official or unofficial capacity. We issued a report on the official civilian militia that was set up by the army. And this is actually interesting because Ramos, Fidel Ramos, who is now going to be president, was, first of all, the person probably responsible directly for setting up this civilian militia, which hasn't been under proper control by the military since it was initiated. But also, if you think about it, he was the person who led the Philippines Constabulary, which was one of the worst abusers of human rights under Marcos. And he led it for a long, long time without any real stigma being attached to him. If Reagan was a Teflon president in the United States, then Ramos was a Teflon general in the Philippines.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sydney Jones. She's the executive director of Asia Watch, a human rights group. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about political and social change in the region of Southeast Asia. My guest is the executive director of Asia Watch, Sydney Jones. One of the things that all human rights groups try to do is really focus international attention on the human rights violations in the part of the world that they're watching. Now that the United States isn't involved in Vietnam, the attention of Americans isn't on Southeast Asia like it once was. Do you find it hard to get the word out about the violations that you're finding out about and to ignite interest about it?
That issue is probably the most frustrating one I have to deal with. It's as though Southeast Asia was utterly off the map as far as most Americans were concerned. You got a little attention to Thailand when the demonstration took place. It may have appeared for a couple of minutes on the evening news, and then it vanishes. You had this massacre in East Timor. You had a few minutes on the evening news. And again, you ask most Americans where East Timor is, and most people wouldn't know. And to try and get any kind of sustained pressure in a country which isn't a major security concern to the United States, in a country where there isn't a major exile population in the United States with any political clout, there are almost no Indonesians except for students in the United States. The Thais certainly aren't a political force. You don't have even Chinese Americans aren't the kind of political force that they could be given their numbers. So it is incredibly frustrating to try and get attention. And the only way to do it is to find a few members of Congress who are interested in an issue enough to push repeatedly to try and put pressure on the administration to look seriously at an issue. But you also realize how few correspondents there are in Southeast Asia. There are almost no foreign correspondents from the United States in Jakarta, for example, and the ones that are there aren't working for major U.S. newspapers or U.S. television channels.
Well, you know, in that respect, I bet that the cuts that so many newspapers and network news operations have faced, you know, the budget cuts and the layoffs, have had a really bad effect on groups like yours because there's fewer reporters based in the countries that you're concerned about.
It's really a major headache, and you have a few reporters based in Bangkok. You have Mary Kay Magstad, who's wonderful for NPR, but there just isn't the kind of coverage in the United States, and the focus on domestic issues here and the kind of insularity of many Americans is a real problem for getting attention. One of the things that we're trying to do now is to get more attention to Japan and more attention from the Japanese government towards the countries in Southeast Asia to which the Japanese provide huge amounts of development aid. And there are Japanese correspondents in all of these countries. The question is how we can try and push for more attention to human rights issues within a country that, first of all, we don't know very well, and secondly, where the institutions that we would normally work through in the U.S. don't really exist. It's a real challenge, but I think there has been a major change on the part of the Japanese government toward taking human rights issues more seriously, particularly in the last 2 years.
The Earth Summit is happening now in Rio, and I'm sure that there are issues about the environment, indigenous populations, and economic development that are pivotal in what's happening now in Southeast Asia. Would you address that for?
I think the biggest environmental issue, which is very much related to the democracy movement in all of these countries, is the interrelationship between military economic interests and logging. You've got a lot of the world's rainforest in Southeast Asia, in Malaysia, in the Philippines, in Thailand, in Burma. And what you find is that one of the biggest sources of foreign exchange is the export of hardwoods, particularly teak, but other forms of wood as well. And in many countries, the military gets these timber concessions and goes into an area. And then not only do they displace indigenous people from the rainforest areas, but they also crack down on anybody that tries to protest against the loggers coming in. And it's a major problem throughout the region, not only environmentally in the sense that there's this depletion of the rainforest, but also in terms of abuse of environmental activists. So that we're increasingly turning to the Environmental Defense Fund and the Natural Resources Defense Council here to try and pool our resources and our efforts to try and get some attention to this issue. The environmental groups can work on the logging side and will work on defense of the activists and protecting their rights to freedom of expression and freedom of association and so on. But we do have to work together. It's been a very interesting development, and it's just over the last 2 years that we've seen the need to work so closely with the environmental groups.
You've been following human rights in Southeast Asia for, well, many years at this point, about a decade.
Mm.
Are there any real changes that you've seen in the types of human rights violations that are being reported?
I think there is one major change, which is that it used to be that all human rights organizations were concerned with the detention of political prisoners for their political beliefs. And this was the major human rights violation throughout the world. What we've seen now is a slight change. There still are certainly political prisoners, but for example, in Indonesia, where there used to be tens of thousands of prisoners accused of supporting the Communist Party in the 1960s, or hundreds and hundreds of East Timorese prisoners in jail in East Timor, which has now been annexed forcibly by Indonesia, you find a different kind of violation taking place now. Most of these countries know that the surest way to get international outrage and international pressure is to keep well-known political prisoners in jail for a long time. So instead, the kind of violation that's taking place is shooting at demonstrators, using lethal force instead of tear gas, for example, in demonstrations, and using force against political opponents in a situation where the military can try to excuse themselves on the grounds that this was mob violence or they were provoked by demonstrators or any other excuse they would choose to use. The only places where you have huge numbers of political prisoners of the kind of old-style human rights situation is certainly in Burma, certainly in China, to some extent in Vietnam, but not as many probably proportionally as in either Burma or China. And in most of the other countries, you're dealing with hundreds, not thousands, of political prisoners and other forms of human rights abuse towards these people.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Sydney Jones is the executive director of the human rights group Asia Watch. Our talk was recorded earlier today before the announcement that phase two of the Cambodia peace process would proceed without the Khmer Rouge. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.